The Fancy Film Fellows employs a frank discussion of cinema that includes adult language and descriptions of mature situations. We have no concern for spoilers, so be warned, you might learn more than you'd care to know.
Welcome back, Fancy Film Fellow fans, fans and friends. This is part two of a podcast you may have already listened to, in which we discussed the Oscar nominees for Best Score in the year 1999, the 1999 films, the 2000 Oscars. Joining me today are the same people who were on that previous podcast, and that is me, Ruben, Basil.
Hello.
And Patrick.
Hello.
We have chosen three movies of those five to watch individually and discuss how the music is used in them. And I guess we'll go in alphabetical order again and start with Basil's pick, which was rewatching American Beauty for the second time this year.
Good times.
how do you think about how the music is used in the movie?
I think we talked about it a little bit, maybe on the previous one, but I did end up feeling more or less similar to what we said, which was something like that the score is very good and it does a lot of heavy lifting for the movie, but it also does feel incongruous often. I think most often with when it's used at the same time as Kevin Spacey's narration, like his narration's so kind of like smug and jokey winky and like very like, ooh, look at me, smart guy. Like, I know everything that, and even though the movie does make fun of him, it's, I feel like a lot of his points, the movie is on his side. And so, like, the kind of ghostliness that especially plays in the background of the score really doesn't land with that in comparison with that. Like, if he, if his delivery were a little more. Yeah, I mean, the lines would probably have to be rewritten too, but if his delivery was more like a kind of weary defeatedness, like, I think it could even still be funny, but and fit better, but like with his jokiness, that kind of like haunted quality that is supposed to kind of inflect the movie with its sadness doesn't really work. I think, but in other moments, I think it does work fine when like nobody's talking at the same time, like the sad piano thing that's mostly associated with Wes Bentley's character a lot of the time. I think when he's like spying on people or they're looking at the plastic bag, like that stuff is all very corny in retrospect, but I think the reason that people thought it worked at the time is because the score is so good and working so well with the scenes, you know, and that then similarly the the weird fantasy sex stuff I also think is pretty funny, the like jangliness of it with like the like while he's like having these very corny fantasies of rose petals and stuff is pretty I like it. Like, I think it's pretty fun. Or like, it adds to the silliness in a way that I think works, and maybe the movie in general would work better if it sort of like leaned into that aspect of it more, rather than as like a, I mean, I guess we've probably talked about it more times on the podcast throughout the years, but if Lester was more of a villain, maybe the movie would work better. I mean, if it were just better written, that would be a great start, but
yeah, I mean, he's kind of a villain in the first three quarters of the movie. They're really keen on redeeming him, and redeeming him in a way that's not good. Like, it's not about him wanting to make reparations or ask forgiveness for the things that he's done. It's about some patriarchal nonsense.
Yeah, for sure. I think a more subtle approach could have worked it better. But I think also, like, the way that Kevin Spacey acts, he is more or less trying to, like, ingratiate you to the character the whole movie. So, like, yeah. I feel like his villainous doesn't really, and especially because it's, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't particularly like Annette Bening's performance, but she isn't trying to do that, and so then it makes it really easy to see their argument as like, oh well, like, Lester's the one who's right and she's the one who sucks or whatever, and so
the nag.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, totally. Like, if you would say, and I would, that this is like kind of like a consumable Blue Velvet for like a more mainstream audience.
Sure.
That Annette Bening would way more easily fit in a David Lynch movie, whereas Kevin Spacey's performance is straight out of almost any other Oscar type movie.
And so that, like, really muddies the water for sure as far as, what the movie is trying to say about these people or whatever. And, I mean, I guess, you know, because he's the narrator. But it would be, I mean, changing the ending would be a good start, I guess, but.
People in the suburbs are messed up, but they have kind hearts. They're really good people on the inside.
Yeah. When push comes to shove, they don't want to be rapists after all.
Yes, they would rather be overbearing patriarchs than rapists, turns out. I forgot
to say that the director of this movie is Sam Mendes, and the composer is Thomas Newman.
Nice. Set up pre-podcast and then forgot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought you had said it already. I think that's why. I think you said it pre-podcast, and I just thought you had said it. I figured out what the soundtrack reminds me of. It's that, like, kind of default ringtone that a lot of iPhones have. That, like, ding. Ding, 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 ding. I feel like that's exactly the like little xylophone riff from a part of the score too. I don't know if that's where that came from, but it would be pretty funny if it was.
I feel like the score was just hugely influential in general on, like, the direction of movie score, so that would not surprise me at all if someone at Apple's like, it sounds nice. I would like to hear that every time somebody gave me a call.
They were like, yeah, this movie's gonna last, it's gonna stand the test of time, we're gonna put it on our phone, it's gonna be like,
well, both classics. iPhone came out like a decade after.
Was it a decade?
Not quite that long, but it was like 2005, the first iPhone or something like that. It was I mean, I was,
or
was
it,
I,
like,
out of college?
Well, wasn't the, it was the iPod first, then the iPhone.
Yeah, but the iPod wouldn't have had a ringtone.
Well, yeah, obviously, but I thought the iPod got big, and then the phone came like a few years later.
That's correct.
After it got,
but the iPod,
we were already a couple of years, several years separated from American Beauty. If they were still listening to it and being like, "This movie's good,"
Probably.
Although I feel like the default ringtone has changed over the years, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably has, yeah.
What about the Wii music? Does it remind you of that?
That would be a much funnier score for this movie.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I should ask about how the music is used in the movie.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, you know, I mean, I feel like it was the one that I had seen while we were, you know, like recently while we were talking about it. So I feel like that was sort of influencing my what we said on the first episode as opposed to the other one. So, I mean, I guess if I think of more stuff, I'll bring it back around. But we can move on to other people who hadn't seen the movie at all before, maybe.
Other movies. So Patrick's pick was The Cider House Rules, directed by Lasse Hallström, with a score by Rachel Portman. Portman.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple Academy Award nominee Rachel Portman. I think I like the way that the score works with this movie. I think it isn't too intrusive. It comes in when it's supposed to. It does kind of a pretty standard job, I feel like, in this movie. There's nothing like overly special. I still like the score a lot, but there wasn't anything that stood out in the way that it was used in the movie. It was like, here's an emotional part and we're going to underline that, and here's a part where you're supposed to feel conflicted, so we're going to underline that, and other than that, we're going to stay out of the way and let the movie play out. And I kind of liked that. Like, this movie in general is like, I would call it very digestible. Although it has like some real bad problems. And I can see people just overlooking them in 1999, but like now I'm like, boy, there's a storyline here that really needs to be cut out of this movie. And a lot of the stuff is kind of ham-fisted about abortion.
Cider House does not rule.
Cider House didn't rule. Mm-hmm. But there was a point, yeah, where I could kind of see this movie like veering into a very interesting direction where they do actually talk about, you know, the Cider House rules were written by someone else that didn't live in this place, so we can just ignore them. I was like, all right, that's an interesting idea. I see where you're going with that, but I don't feel like it ever gets followed through, and I think it gets eschewed in favor of just kind of like bland like love story drama and the very, very bad, I guess I'll go ahead and talk about it, like the very bad race problem this movie has, where it's just like, here we're going to introduce one or two prominent black characters and one of them is just going to be a monster and the other one is a hapless victim. And I was just like, okay, this is real problematic in the middle of this movie about, like, you know, virtuous white people who help orphans and women in need. So yeah, I was not thrilled with that, but I don't know, like, the movie didn't, I don't know, it didn't make me hate it. I was just like, it seemed like a big missed opportunity. It was like someone could have stepped in and been like, hey, why don't we do this differently or something like that. Like, I think with some tweaks, this could be a movie that I really liked. But unfortunately, I think it's a story problem.
I haven't seen it, so cannot comment.
Yeah,
but
it's a... Yeah, it's, I don't know, I also kind of like enjoyed the way it unfolded.
Is there any narration from dogs?
There's no narration from dogs. There is some Michael Caine narration, though, which is kind of fun. Like, Michael Caine does give a good performance. I see why he won an Oscar for this performance. It's a pretty good performance. Also to make another tie to Blue Velvet. He's an ether sniffing kind of weirdo a little bit too, which I thought was kind of fun. I was like, oh, okay, this guy's supposed to be sort of like the virtuous father figure, but he's also an ether sniffing weirdo who has like two women that live with him basically, and is like, you know, kind of like a swinger a little bit. I was like, oh, all right, okay. It's kind of funny to me, but you know what, whatever. Showing that the, you know, the past is not as like lily white, like clean cut as people like to remember it. I kind of liked that about this movie, where it wasn't one of those like, oh, everyone was virtuous and upstanding back in the day when World War II was happening, and I was like, okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yep, that's, I mean, other than that, I don't think that there's anything outstanding about this. I did look into Rachel Portman as a composer a little more, looked up some more of her stuff. Also, kind of inadvertently, I guess, because she also did Ratcatcher, which we talked about on an earlier podcast, and she was also the composer for the movie Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, which I found out that she did that as I was watching it on Netflix, because my girlfriend was like, oh, you haven't seen this movie? We need to see it. So I was like, okay, all right, we'll watch it. And I was like, hey, I recognize that name. That's the composer that I'm supposed to be talking about on a podcast. So apparently her fingerprints are all over the musical landscape of the 90s cinema.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. I saw a tweet because Ruben and Jeremy both commented on it to say favorite composer that's not John Williams or Hans Zimmer or whatever, and a lot of people answered Rachel Portman. I was surprised.
Yeah, and I also kind of started listening to her next project, which was Chocolat, which was, she was also nominated for, and there's a song right at the beginning of it. I don't know if that's a song that she composed originally, but it's like the generic, like, we're doing a cooking show music that you probably hear on like a million cooking shows.
That's funny.
It's I think it's called like mid-tempo swing or something like that, and it's just like the we're doing cooking music. And I was like, wow, it would be crazy if she composed that as well, like her fingerprints are everywhere. I didn't even know about it. But yeah,
that's pretty fun. Yeah, also Lasse Hallström
for that. Yeah, and I will say that I know that when we talked about the score before, Basil, you mentioned it kind of having this like Norman Rockwell-esque quality. And I think that kind of works with the, I guess, one of the themes of the movie, which is this idea that like it is a movie that kind of delves into to like societal problems in the way that this past is not as idealized as people make it out to be. And so I'm like, it kind of works that you put this very, you know, Norman Rockwell-esque like feel good score underneath this movie that's about all of these very serious problems that these people are having, especially the societal problem of, you know, women not being able to get free and legal abortions.
Sure.
So I was like, that works for me.
Nice. Yeah. I had a feeling that might be the, at least part of the case.
Okay.
All right.
And rounding out is The Talented Mr. Ripley, directed by Anthony Mingola, scored by Gabriel Yared. So I think on the last podcast I talked about how this was my second favorite and was kind of interested in it because it was a little diverse, like there was a couple of different styles of music going on, and I think I said something similar about what was the movie that we did, also 1999, the Australian
Holy Smoke.
Holy Smoke, yeah. I said something similar about that, and that I was curious to see how these diverse elements were used. And I think I should probably take back most bad things I say about composers. I think directors just don't know what do with this. Like, they don't care about music, or they don't put a lot of thought into it. Like, almost everything, every track in this, it like sounds diverse, separate from the movie, and then it's like sort of almost exactly the scene that you would imagine. So it mostly takes place in Italy. So when it's like kind of a choral arrangement or whatever, it's like a strange Catholic ritual or something like that scene that's not super involved with the plot. That's just like kind of atmospheric or for the mood. And then there's a part in the middle of the movie where, of course, Mr. Ripley is pretending to be Mr. Greenleaf. And that's when the like, he's like peering around corners and stuff like that. And, Matt Damon singing is still really funny in the movie. My little Valentine, Mr. Funny Valentine. You know, and then like the lush music is for the more overtly queer moments of the film, where it's like, ooh, is something going to happen between these two men or these two other men? And it's just kind of like, all right, I don't know when it was composed or how it's composed in the movie, but you took something kind of interesting and you just sort of were very functional, I guess, in the way in which you used it. Like, sure. The whole idea of sort of like Dickie's love of jazz is being like sort of like, I don't know, representing his wildness, but also like his the way in which he sort of like takes from the poor, I guess. I don't know exactly how to put that. Like, he's like a little bit of a leech. But he doesn't really like it. And then like, I don't know, like superimposed on Italy's own like post-war poverty, but its cultural background being like way more serious in a way, like, or more culturally taken more culturally significantly, especially at this time. I don't know exactly when the movie takes place, like the 50s or 60s, I think.
Sure.
There could be like something interesting there in the music, and the movie doesn't really tug at those chords at all. It's just like, jazz scene. Mm-hmm. Italian music scene. Jazz scene. It's like, I guess these scenes are all fine by their own, and it's certainly not bad. But it definitely, I was like, oh, well, now that I've seen it in the context of the movie, or I guess re-seen it, because I did watch the movie when... in like 1999 or 2000 or 2001, sometime around then. But I remembered very, very little of it. I just remembered that there was a part where Gwyneth Paltrow's character was like confronting Matt Damon's character, and I remembered that Philip Seymour Hoffman was a jerk. That was about it.
You don't say. Philip Seymour Hoffman playing a jerk in a movie? Get out of town.
Funny, because I actually, even though he's not my favorite actor, I think casting wise it would have actually made more sense if he and Matt Damon switched roles. Like, because Ripley is supposed to be like a little bit of a loser, a little bit of like a hanger-oner, and maybe it's just because like of like Boogie Nights and other things. I can like really easily see Philip Seymour Hoffman in that role, whereas like he is playing like a fellow Princetonian like frat guy who is very judgmental about other people. Like, I don't know. Even though I think Matt Damon is a better actor, I think he would be more suited for that role.
Sure.
It's definitely sort of like a who's who of casting in 1999, though.
Right.
It's pretty much like the all-stars. It was like, we got Jude Law, we got Gwyneth Paltrow, we got Matt Damon, we got Philip Seymour Hoffman, we got Cate Blanchett. Like, if you're blonde and a popular actor in 1999, you are a star of The Talented Mr. Ripley. So yeah, you know, I just it seems like it's something that, well, I mean, just I think in general, my experience with movies is that they're like seven different art forms combined, and that for the most part, people only pay attention to like two of those seven, sometimes three, and that things like titles and scores and cinematography just get ignored. They're like, they're just paths to a story.
Right.
And it's like, okay, I guess, like, I could just read the story, which I probably will do at this point, because watching the movie, I was like, there are a lot of interesting threads here, and I wonder if someone who I was more impressed with artistically could, you know,
have done
weave something. Them, yeah, weave them into something more interesting.
I remember liking the novel, but I was a lot younger when I read it, so be curious to see how I feel about it now. But yeah, it's and it's same with the movie, I guess. The last time I watched it, I liked it, but I don't remember too much about it. And
it's fine.
That's what I figured. What you said reminded me, I should have listened to more of Thomas Newman's scores if I thought about it, because I would be curious, like, of if, like, this is just sort of like emblematic of his style, or if actually Sam Mendes did request like a pretty unusual score for the movie. And because it does seem like a thing that you know, you don't arrive at accidentally. And that would be that would have been some good stuff to say, probably, to opine about, if I knew. But it is yeah, I mean, like, it is interesting to see when a director does take, I mean, I guess, like, the most obvious example is like action movies and how they all sound exactly the same now, and it's like, every time you see one that doesn't, you're like, oh, hey, this person decided not to go the route that everyone goes with their score. I mean,
Hans Zimmer's score.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bummer that, like, I'd be very curious to hear Johan Johansson's original score for Blade Runner, because it got replaced by the by Hans Zimmer, but but he's a weird composer, so I'd be like, that was part of the reason why I was very excited about the movie. I was like, ooh, I like Denis Villeneuve. His last few movies have been pretty cool. And Johan Johansson does really weird scores, and I like that too. I mean, Sicario has a really weird score for an action movie, for sure. But never happened, I guess.
Yeah, I just looked up Gabriel Yared's composerography, and before The English Patient, he was still working with Anthony Minghella a lot, but it was, you know, back when they were in France together, working together, so a lot of French films. And then he switched over, and then it seems like once you get nominated for a couple Oscars, then you do a lot of the same type of movie.
Yeah, so, for sure.
He did Cold Mountain.
That's another Mingla.
Oh, is it? Yeah, he did the Tourist. Oh no, that score was rejected and replaced by James Newton Howard. Yeah. A Promise, By the Sea, the 2016 Chocolat.
That's funny. There's a 2016 Chocolat.
Yeah,
I never even heard of that.
Yeah, me neither.
Thomas Newman did. I guess he's done every single Sam Mendes movie since then. They like working together, but so he did the score to 1917, but I don't remember it. I don't remember what it sounds like.
Bless you. Not in 2004, a Yard's score for the film Troy was rejected less than a month before the film's opening as a result of the poor reception by a test screening audience. Test audience were said to have found Yared's music too brassy and bold. James Horner, the composer of scores such as Braveheart and Titanic, was then hired as a replacement in less than 4 weeks.
Wild.
Whoa, we're stumbling into some composer drama here. That's fascinating.
Yeah, he also did, I guess, Newman did both the James Bond movies that Mendes did. I don't remember what those sound like either, other than, you know, the James Bond. Like, how much composing goes on in a James Bond
movie? Yeah, yeah, in that situation, like, where you're just different, like, well, here's some James Bond music, just put it wherever, I guess.
It's like, all right, what should we do here? Bottom, boom, bottom, boom.
Well, what's James Bond doing? Well, right here, he's sneaking around. Boom. Boom, boom, boom. Oh, here he's punching somebody.
Film score critic Christian Clemenson at filmtracks.com felt that Yared's work for Troy was far superior to what Horner had written, giving Horner's score a 3-star rating and Yared's a 5-star rating, saying that it was outstanding and called it the pinnacle of Yared's career.
Release Bummer. The Yared cut.
Warner Brothers owns the rights and has never released it, and may never.
We should start this campaign. Release the Yared cut.
If they can invest $70 million in more Justice League filming for the Snyder cut.
Oh, Justice League.
They can invest $10,000. And releasing the Yared score of Troy. My new favorite composer, Gabriel Yared.
Yeah. Thomas Newman also did Shawshank Redemption. That has a good score. I like the music in that.
Yeah. Did he do any other Darabont movies?
I don't see. Oh, yeah, he did The Green Mile.
I was going to say, I was like, I bet he did The Green Mile too. That makes a lot of sense.
These composers were busy in 1999.
Yeah, that's true. Two Portman different also ones. Also
had two, yeah. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he's worked with Soderbergh somewhat regularly as well. Mm. Did Aaron Brockovich, the good German.
Gabriel Yared did one of Ebert's favorite movies and one of his least favorite movies of 1999, The Talented Mr. Ripley and Message in a Bottle.
Nice.
Message in a Bottle, what is that?
Kevin Costner movie based on a Nicholas Sparks novel.
Oh no. That sounds real bad.
Newman also did the score to WALL-E.
Oh, nice. I think I kind of remember that one, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's got a bunch of Hello Dolly cues in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I always wonder about that, like, when there are scores, because I remember, I think there was, like, some amount of controversy over the There Will Be Blood score that Johnny Greenwood did not getting nominated because he used I think it was like a musical run from a classical composition, so they were like, well, it's not original, so they actually like kicked it out of competition. And I was like, ooh, I wonder like how much of that is actually looked into in some of these other scores. Because, like, I've heard people say that, like, a lot of the times John Williams will just use, like, musical runs from other classical compositions.
Mm-hmm. Duel of the Fates is just Mars.
I was going to say, it's like a lot of his stuff just sounds like, you know, older pieces like that. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'm like, well, how do you, like, look into that and make that determination for, like, well, this is original, but this isn't? Because I think the same thing happened with the songs in was that Coen Brothers movie? I'm trying to remember the name of it now.
Brother,
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Inside
Llewyn Davis. It got the songs in it got disqualified because they were essentially like reworkings of old folk music songs.
Sure.
Like the one that I guess everybody knows. I forget the name of it now. If I had wings, like, mm-hmm. That was actually a reworking of a Bob Dylan song that they just like changed the chord structure.
Dink's
that Dylan
song.
Dink's song, that's what it's called. That they changed the chord structure that Dylan used for it into a more like, I guess, like traditional chord structure that like rose and fall. And Dylan's version was a lot more spare, and it was a lot more like kind of atonal.
Sure.
So they reworked it into like something that sounded like it was like a sweeping movie song. But the Academy was like, nope, it's a previous composition. Get it out of here.
That's wild.
Yep. The rules for that stuff are kind of unclear to me at times.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder if that has happened to John Williams, because, I mean, he doesn't always win the Oscar. So, like, yeah. It's possible some of his scores just weren't nominated for the reason, but... But I don't know. I mean, apparently Hans Zimmer's can be nominated for plagiarizing himself constantly. So,
yeah, it's true. I wonder how much of that gets thrown out. It's like this is the same score you did for Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, it's just you just changed like a few little themes here and there. Can I help you?
Cat time.
It's Indie time. She wants to be on the podcast. Indie.
Wow.
You want to be on the podcast?
She does indeed. She loves it, I can see.
Yep. You can tell she loves it because she's struggling to get away.
Stop gaslighting our cat. I don't know. I guess that's it for.
I mean, this ended up going longer. I thought it was going to be a 20-minute podcast, and I was like, "Oh no, we should have just done it as an addendum to, like we normally do," even though the other one went longer. But,
I think since I've been watching some, I'm probably going to have like a full top five. Best scores of 1999, and I think Only American Beauty is going to make my list.
Sure.
Apologies to the other four.
Well, I guess we'll just have to nominate some different ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. I don't know what's coming out next, but... possibly more 1999 stuff.
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
We have a couple other things that we want to do before the end of the year. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably if you keep watching 1999 movies, you'll just hit on it eventually.
Hell yeah. Keep it up.
You can find all of our content on fancyfilmfellows.com. If you have any issues, questions, concerns, you can reach us at our email. fancyfilmfellows@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Please like and subscribe. And thank you, Basil and Patrick, for going on this Oscar composer journey with me.
Don't mention that.
Woo.
Glad to be here.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.